Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
So here we are on a rainy day in the richest country in the world, in the richest state in the country, in a state as blue as it can be, and in a city rife with millionaires, where teachers have to go on strike to get the basics for our students. Public education is not your plaything, billionaires. It belongs to the people of Los Angeles.
More than 30,000 teachers in the nation's second largest school district have gone on strike for the first time in 30 years. We'll go to Los Angeles for the latest. Then confirmation hearings begin for William Barr, President Trump's pick to become attorney general, the position Barr held under George H.W. Bush.
During his tenure, he demonstrated an unwavering adherence to the rule of law, which the people in this room like to hear. There's no one more capable or more qualified for this role.
As William Barr heads to Capitol Hill, well, senators asked about his embrace of sweeping executive power, mass incarceration, indefinite detention, and warrantless surveillance. Then no more deaths. We go to Tucson, Arizona, where nine activists are facing federal charges for leaving water and food in the harsh Sonoran Desert to help migrants survive the potentially deadly journey across the U.S. border. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Los Angeles, 32,000 public school teachers went on strike Monday, many of them braving the pouring rain alongside their supporters as they marched through downtown Los Angeles. Teachers are demanding smaller class sizes, higher pay, the regulation of charter schools, and more nurses, counselors, and librarians. The strike is the first such action in nearly 30 years. The strike is organized by the United Teachers Los Angeles. It's effectively shut down the nation's second largest school district. This is Toby Smith, who teaches up to 200 students a day.
We are pinned up against the wall. We have no other choice. If we don't, they're just going to keep cramming us into classes. They're going to cram the kids in like sardines. They're going to starve us out, and then charter schools will be the only schools. So it's now or never. It's do or die for us.
We'll have more on the Los Angeles teacher strikes after headlines with strike leader and teacher Cecily Myard-Cruz and author and journalist Eric Blank. Senate confirmation hearings begin today for William Barr, President Trump's nominee for the attorney general seat, left open after Jeff Sessions' firing in November. Barr, a former attorney general for George H.W. Bush, is known for his expansive view of executive power, but he's reportedly planning on reassuring senators he'll protect special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe. According to prepared testimony, Barr's opening statement says it's vitally important Mueller be able to complete his investigation. Democratic senators are expected to press Barr over an unsolicited memo he sent to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein in June, in which he criticized Mueller's investigation. In addition to sending the memo to Rosenstein, Barr acknowledged he also shared it with most of Trump's lawyers and discussed it with several of them. We'll have more on the story later in the program with Vince Warren of the Center for Constitutional Rights. The longest government shutdown in U.S. history enters its 25th day as 800,000 federal workers are either working without pay or have been furloughed. No signs of a breakthrough are apparent in Washington as Trump continues to insist on $5.7 billion for funding his border wall. Meanwhile, in New York City, a number of prisoners at a downtown Manhattan jail launched a hunger strike Monday to protest the cancellation of family visits due to staffing shortages related to the government shutdown. Some prisoners at the Metropolitan Correctional Center have also reportedly not received medications. At a federal judge in Brooklyn, lawyers report not being able to visit their clients because of staff shortages. In Poland, the mayor of Gdansk, Paweł Adamowicz, died on Monday, one day after he was stabbed on stage during a charity event. The attacker, who's been charged with murder, reportedly yelled from the stage he was wrongfully imprisoned under the government of the Civic Platform Party, which the mayor used to belong to. Adamowicz has been the mayor of the port city of Gdansk since 1998 and was a staunch critic of the right-wing Polish government. He espoused liberal policies and ideas defending LGBTQ rights and immigrant rights. Crowds gathered Monday to pay tribute to the murdered mayor. This is Donald Tusk, president of the European Council, originally from Gdansk and a friend of the mayor.
And today I went to promise to dear God and all names, the people of Gdansk, Poles and Europeans, that for you and for everyone, we will protect our Gdansk, our Poland and our Europe, that hatred will not prevail. We will stand up against it. Goodbye.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban claimed responsibility for a car bomb that killed at least five people, wounded at least 100 others in the capital, Kabul, Monday. The explosion went off near a high-security international compound. Officials say most of the victims were civilians, and the wounded included scores of children. In more news from Afghanistan, Human Rights Watch is calling for the international community to impose sanctions and investigate recently appointed defense minister, Asadullah Khalid. Khalid, a former governor of Kandahar, is accused of committing war crimes and human rights abuses, including enforced disappearances, torturing prisoners, and ordering the murder of five UN workers in 2007. The human rights group also says there's evidence Khalid committed acts of sexual violence against women and girls. In Britain, members of Parliament are voting today on Prime Minister Theresa May's highly contested Brexit deal. On Monday, May made a final plea to members of Parliament to support the deal.
No, it is not perfect, and yes, it is a compromise. But when the history books are written, people will look at the decision. People will look at the decision of this House tomorrow and ask, did we deliver on the country's vote to leave the European Union? Did we safeguard our economy, our security, and our union? Did we let the British people down?
It's unclear what will happen if the deal is rejected, although some have said the UK could hold a second referendum on leaving the European Union. Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn has called for a general election and a new government if May fails to get parliamentary backing for the existing agreement. In Pennsylvania, a federal judge blocked new rules from the Trump administration Monday that would have severely limited women's access to reproductive care by allowing employers to opt out of an Affordable Care Act requirement to provide birth control as part of female employees' health care. Judge Wendy Beadlestone wrote in her opinion, quote, the negative effects of even a short period of decreased access to no-cost contraceptive services are irreversible. Unquote. On Sunday, a judge in California issued a similar injunction, but it only applied to the 13 states in the District of Columbia who were part of that lawsuit. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is missing oral arguments for a second week as she continues to recover after having two tumors removed from her lung last month. The Supreme Court said Friday Justice Ginsburg is cancer-free. The 85-year-old, now three-time cancer-surviving justice, has been reviewing arguments and weighing in on cases from home. In more news from the Supreme Court, the justices have declined to take up a case challenging the legality of Trump's appointment of Matthew Whitaker as acting attorney general after Jeff Sessions firing in November. In California, Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, will file for bankruptcy as it faces up to $30 billion in liability, as well as multiple investigations. California has experienced increasingly devastating wildfires in recent years. In November of 2018, the Camp Fire, the state's deadliest wildfire, decimated the town of Paradise in Northern California, killing at least 86 people. The California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, known as CAL FIRE, is investigating possible issues with some of the utility power lines and towers as the cause of the fire. CAL FIRE previously found many of the worst forest fires in Northern California in 2017 were caused by power lines, poles, or other equipment run by PG&E. House Republican leaders have voted unanimously to block Iowa Congressmember Steve King from serving on any committees amidst the outrage following his latest comments in a recent New York Times interview. King praised white supremacy, saying, quote, white nationalist, white supremacist, Western civilization, how did that language become offensive, unquote. Meanwhile, House Democrats are preparing their own actions, including resolutions to censure King over his comments. In environmental news, the Associated Press is reporting the Environmental Protection Agency referred just 166 pollution cases for prosecution in 2018, the lowest number in 30 years. The executive director of the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, the group which released the data, said, quote, "You don't get closer to the core of EPA's mission than enforcing the law. We're reaching levels where the enforcement program is lacking a pulse." A new report from the Associated Press found the U.S. government approved thousands of requests to bring underage brides into the United States over the past decade, a practice that results in numerous forced and abusive marriages. There's no minimum age requirement when making a spousal or fiancé immigration claim. As U.S. immigration services consider whether a marriage is legal in the spouse or fiancé's home country, the marriage must also be legal in the state where the petitioner lives, and all U.S. states either have laws or exceptions allowing for a minor to be married. So you had men in their 40s requesting and getting approval for 15-year-old child brides to come to the United States to marry them. And in Connecticut, the families of six victims of the 2012 mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School scored a legal victory Friday when a judge ruled they can access internal documents from conservative conspiracy theorist and internet personality Alex Jones and his website InfoWars. The families of the victims argue Jones fabricated and perpetuated lies about the Sandy Hook massacre, portraying the event as a hoax and the victims' families as paid actors. They say Jones engaged in a, quote, years-long campaign of abusive and outrageous false statements, unquote, which resulted in online harassment and death threats against the plaintiffs. The massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary claimed the lives of 20 school children aged 6 to 7 and 6 school staff members. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Los Angeles, where public school teachers are on strike for the first time in three decades. On Monday morning, tens of thousands of teachers braved pouring rain on the picket line for the strike's first day. Some 20,000 people marched through downtown Los Angeles demanding smaller class size, higher pay, regulation of charter schools, and more nurses, counselors, and librarians. Over 31,000 members of United Teachers Los Angeles are striking. This is UTLA President Alex Caputo-Pearl speaking to a crowd of striking teachers Monday.
So here we are. On a rainy day in the richest country in the world, in the richest state in the country, in a state as blue as it can be, and in a city rife with millionaires, where teachers have to go on strike to get the basics for our students. Public education is not your plaything, billionaires. It belongs to the people of Los Angeles.
The strike follows more than 20 months of strained negotiations between UTLA and the school district, which fell apart last week as the two parties failed to come to an agreement. The strike has effectively shut down Los Angeles Unified, the nation's second largest school district, with only one-third of the district's nearly 500,000 students showing up for school Monday. The new California governor, Gavin Newsom's calling for both sides to return to the negotiating table, saying in a statement, quote, "This impasse is disrupting the lives of too many kids and their families," unquote. The walkout follows a red wave of teacher strikes from West Virginia to Arizona last year. Well, for more, we go now to Los Angeles, California, where we're joined by two guests, Cecily Myard-Cruz, strike leader and National Education Association vice president at United Teachers Los Angeles. She's been a teacher in the Los Angeles Unified School District for the past two decades. And we're joined by Eric Blanc, who's been covering the strike for The Guardian and Jacobin. He's author of the forthcoming book, Red State Revolt, The Teachers' Strike, Wave, and Working Class Politics. Cecily Myard-Cruz and Eric Blanc, welcome to Democracy Now! Cecily Myard-Cruz, let's begin with you. Why don't you lay out while nearly 32,000 teachers are on strike?
Yes, we are on strike in an epic, historic three decades in the making. We're on strike because it's really lack of respect. We want lower class sizes. We need staffing. Nurses, over 80% of our schools do not have a full-time nurse. And And that's why we're there. We want the district to come to an agreement that services have been disinvested in our school system for far too long.
I want to turn to some of the students who came out in support of the teachers Monday. This is 15-year-old Nicole Mogul, a 10th grader at John Marshall High School.
You know, our teachers need our support, you know, the student support. And they need to know that, you know, we're on their side and that we want them to have, you know, a better, like, pay and just better conditions.
And this is 17-year-old Andrew Montoya, a senior at John Marshall High.
Oh, we can have 40 kids, so upwards to like 48 in some of my classes. And I mean, that's a hard learning environment for anyone and for a teacher to organize, you know?
Eric Blanc, can you put this in context as you look at the history of this teacher strike and the teacher strike, what are called the red wave around the country? Why is this happening now? And is it at all significant that a new governor of California is now in charge, Gavin Newsom?
Yeah, I think that fundamentally this struggle is part of a nationwide struggle of education. Last year, you might remember, it was said that, well, the strikes were a red state revolt. It's just in the lowest paid states, Republican states. But what we've seen with this movement erupting in Los Angeles, that actually the same problems of underfunding, privatization, low wages, that's clearly a nationwide problem. And it's been imposed by policies of austerity by both Republicans and Democrats. So I think the significance is twofold. On the one hand, it's made clear that this is a struggle of teachers and educators across the country. And I think in particular, the question of privatization here in Los Angeles has been put to the fore.
You have an interesting piece in The Nation where you write, pro-charter billionaires like Eli Broad and Reed Hastings spent an unprecedented $9.7 million in the spring of 2017 to ensure the election of a pro-privatization majority in the school board. Explain that further, Eric.
Right. So the most important thing to understand about this strike, I think, is that fundamentally it's about whether public education will continue to exist in Los Angeles or not. There's two plans. The plan of Austin Buettner, who's the new superintendent, who is imposed by billionaires who bought the 2017 elections, has a plan to downsize the district, yes, to push students into charter schools. And the vision of the teachers and parents in the union is the contrary. It's to not only defend but preserve the schools and make them actually serve the needs of the majority of students. So what we see by Buettner is fundamentally a push to really dismantle the institution that he's nominally supposed to be leading. And so he says that there's a financial crisis, that he would love to meet the demands of teachers. But we know that there's actually a $1.86 billion reserve. And so what's at stake is he doesn't want to use that money to improve the schools, because if he were to do that, it would undermine his mission to basically dismantle and privatize L.A. public schools.
This is Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti.
For some time, L.A. teachers and the Los Angeles Unified School District have been engaged in contract negotiations. This past week produced good results, with very important face-to-face negotiations and real movement. But unfortunately, talks broke down on Friday, and teachers are set to strike tomorrow. I stand with our teachers and agree that L.A. kids deserve smaller classes, more support staff, and community-focused schools. All parents deserve to know that their children are safe and attending great schools. We must also ensure the long-term fiscal health of the district. I deeply believe there is a lot more that unites us than separates us, and that a just, fair, and responsible deal needs to be our immediate priority.
Cecily Myatt-Cruz, if you can talk about the negotiations that are currently taking place. The latest offer to the union includes a full-time nurse for every elementary school. District reports its offer adds about $130 million and 1,200 positions to previous proposals. Increased staffing limited to 1 year. Talk more about all of this.
Right. And I think you just capped it at the end. All of those supports that were laid out are 1 year guarantee. So putting in supports, an additional nurse, it's choosing one or the other, a nurse or a class size reduction teacher, and that staffing would only stay for 1 year. We know that that's not sustainable within a school when you're trying to work on trauma-informed care, having psychologists. We shouldn't have to choose having a nurse, a counselor, a psychologist, or a class size reduction teacher. All of those staffing needs are important, and we need that for our students. We know that the students' learning conditions are the educators' working conditions, and that's really what's at stake here.
So, according to the New York Times, more than 80% of the students qualify for free or reduced-price lunch. Latinos make up roughly 75% of all students, while whites and African Americans account for less than 10% of enrollment. Talk about the significance of all of this.
Well, I think that the significance is the what Eric brought up, a systematic defunding of public education over many years. I graduated from this LA Unified School District in 1990, and we had a nurse at our site every day. We had lower class sizes. So when we're talking about a systematic underfunding of public education, we're talking about a privatization model that has swept the country, and particularly here in Los Angeles, when you have 287% unregulated charter growth, where $600 million is not recouped from to come back into our general fund and is given to unregulated charter growth, that is a problem. The district is not utilizing that, but that is the plan. The plan is to dismantle our school district and really dismantle public education, and we're not going for that.
So the Los Angeles Times is saying an estimated 400 substitutes have been called in, 2,000 staffers from central and regional offices filled in for 31,000 teachers, nurses, librarians, and counselors. At 10 schools, non-teaching employees are taking part in a sympathy strike. So describe what is happening now and what the plans are. I know today another call for massive presence and rallies around Los Angeles, Cecily.
Yes. And so there's a few unique things that happened. We did hear reports that 50 kids out of 500 attended schools yesterday. folks are very sympathetic. Parents have been on the line and energetic with us. Students have been on the line. And today, the accelerated charter school is going on strike. So it's a unionized charter school that's going on strike. Their employer is obviously not LAUSD, but they are also feeling the same effects of what we are feeling. And the sentiment out there, if you saw the pictures yesterday, I think that says it all. Folks were out, rain or shine, to walk these lines in front of their schools and then converge on downtown Los Angeles in a way that I have never seen before. Energetic, but saying, we need better. Our students deserve more, and privatization has to go. And so today, we are taking the fight right to the charter industry at the California Charter School Association. So I can't wait to be there to show what's happening with the privatization piece and put it on display for everyone.
And Eric Blank, this is very interesting. This is not only about teacher pay raises. It's about so much more. So talk more about this association, the focal point of the protests today, and then put it into the context of what's happening around the country.
Right. So, as I mentioned before, the stakes of what we're seeing in Los Angeles have national implications. I think that really what happens here is going to determine for the foreseeable future a lot of the dynamics around public education. Educators across the country are looking to see, can Los Angeles and will Los Angeles teachers fight back and win against the same types of forces that are trying to impose the same types of policies of austerity and privatization in their schools? And I think, conversely, the billionaires are very much aware of what's happening in Los Angeles and consciously funding the campaigns of Buettner to lie about what teachers are doing, just to have a systematic smear campaign in the press. So important stakes, there's really important stakes to what we're seeing here. And there's important vested interests on both sides, both for labor and for the billionaires that would like to see the dismantling of public schools. So I think that really the strike wave that began in West Virginia continues. And Los Angeles, in turn, when teachers win, I think we should expect a percolation and really a ripple effect, not just to the red states, but now to blue states. Los Angeles could be followed by Oakland teachers are talking about striking in February. Denver teachers, South Carolina, Virginia. Mm-hmm. So really, this education movement has just started, and I don't even think that we've seen how far it will go.
Eric, you—
Yeah, go ahead.
You were formerly a teacher in the Bay Area. Why do you think teachers are now on the front lines of a radical working class resistance today?
Right. I think the most important thing to keep in mind there is that public education is like the last bastion of the public sector in the United States. They've taken away most of everything else we have and put it into private hands. And so really what you're seeing is working people really concentrating around public education as the last right that we have for all people in this country. And so at the same time, big business wants to dismantle this because they know that if they can lower people's expectations, that they don't deserve anything, then it's going to be much harder to fight for other gains that we need, such as Medicare for All or Green New Deal. So really what we're seeing is this going to be a country that uses its vast wealth to fund human needs, or is it going to be using this wealth to fund, you know, really big billionaires? And I think it's a very hopeful moment because Los Angeles teachers are showing that it's possible to change these policies. I think a lot of times people feel that things should be different, but they don't have a sense of power. And really what Los Angeles, like the other strikes that have come before it, is giving working class people a sense that they can change the world and is showing them the means through which they can do that.
Mm. Arne Duncan, the former Secretary of Education under President Obama, said LA Unified is spending $500 million more each year than it brings in and is headed toward insolvency in about 2 years if nothing changes. It simply does not have the money to fund UTLA's demands. Cecily Meyer-Cruz, can you respond?
Sure, I can. You know, Arne Duncan comes from the same path of Betsy DeVos, another privatizer who thinks they know education. And in turn, that's the same way our superintendent thinks, because he's a privatizer. No, we're not going to be headed for insolvency if they don't act. And what do I mean by that? We conducted a EIR, an economic impact report, several years ago, saying what's the damage done by unregulated charter growth. I said that before, so I'll repeat it. Over the last 10 years, we have had 287% unregulated charter growth. So with that comes money attached, because the school board, and that's the Broad-back, billionaire-backed school board, they, every school board session, are approving new charters, co-locations and such, to the tune of $600 million a year. So that's money that comes out of the general fund that could fund all of these things. Not everything, but some things can be funded through $600 million a year. Now, of course, we need to also be looking at the state. We also should be looking at reforming Prop 13, and that will be on the ballot in 2020, and it's called Schools and Communities First. It will put $11 billion into education. That's another thing. So we have to start attacking all the places that bring in the revenue and the resources right into Los Angeles and, heck, California writ large.
And Cecily, your message to the 500,000 students in Los Angeles Unified District?
My message is, students, we're doing this for you. You are the future. And we cannot expect you to be the future if we put you last. So we are doing this for you. Stay strong. Stay with us. Be on the lines with us. But demand what you want to see change. Demand that from the legislators. Demand it from the politicians. But let's start right here in Los Angeles and start demanding this, not only of the superintendent who has zero educational experience, but let's demand that from the school board members as well.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Cecily Meyer-Cruz, strike leader, vice president with UTLA, and Eric Blanc, reporter covering nationwide teacher strikes with Jacobin and The Guardian. His new piece for The Guardian will link to LA's teachers can teach the working class about the power of labor strikes. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, today begins the confirmation hearing for William Barr as attorney general. We'll speak with Vince Warren of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Stay with us. By Earl Sweatshirt. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Senate confirmation hearings begin today for William Barr, President Trump's nominee for attorney general to replace Jeff Sessions, who was fired in November. Barr served as attorney general for George H.W. Bush from 1991 to 93. During that time, he was involved in the pardon of six Reagan officials for the Iran-Contra scandal and oversaw the opening of the Guantanamo Bay military prison, which was initially used to indefinitely detain HIV-positive asylum seekers from Haiti. One federal judge accused the Bush administration of creating an HIV prison camp. Barr openly backed mass incarceration at home as well. As attorney general, he once wrote the introduction to a report titled The Case for More Incarceration. According to the ACLU, William Barr also helped develop a secret Drug Enforcement Administration program, which became a blueprint for the National Security Agency's mass phone surveillance effort. After leaving government, Barr became general counsel at Verizon at a time when the telecom giant was secretly working with the NSA warrantless surveillance program. Today's hearing is expected to focus in part on the future of special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe. According to his prepared remarks, Barr's expected to say it's vitally important Mueller be allowed to complete his investigation. But last year, Barr sent an unsolicited memo to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein in June, in which he criticized Mueller's investigation. He then, and this news has just come out this week, apparently spoke privately with Trump's attorneys about the memo and his case for protecting executive privilege and executive power. We're joined now by Vince Warren, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's good to have you with us, Vince.
Hi.
Talk about what you think needs to happen today, the kinds of questions that William Barr should be asked by the senators.
Well, Amy, there are two really big overlays here. The first one is around his view of presidential power, Barr's views of presidential power, and specifically those views that were articulated to the Trump administration and now apparently the Trump lawyers in an unsolicited memo. I don't know who writes a memo to the president of the United States saying that the the special counsel is overseeing their overstepping their bounds, but that's what he did. And that's important, of course, because, as we know, President Trump is very hot to get himself out of the hot seat, and he's looking for anybody who will push back on that and perhaps even fire the special counsel. So that's one part of it. The other part, I think, is equally as important, and I think that folks need to keep their eye on this. Even if he says the magic words that I will let the special counsel do his job, I will not fire the special counsel, I will read the report when it comes out, he's got a long history of being not only a law and order attorney general, but he's espoused views that expand presidential power, not just internationally with respect to, for example, going into the first Iraq war, but also with respect to mass incarceration of hundreds of thousands of people here in the United States, and a very bad track record on the question of asylum, people coming into the United States as well. So all of those issues, I think, need to be moved forward. He was approved, I think, almost unanimously by the Democrats last time he went through this process. He likely will be approved again, unfortunately. But people need to keep their eye on the idea that even if he says the magic words, he's really bad news for the trajectory that the country's going in now.
So, in addition to consulting with the Trump's lawyers around how to limit the probe or whatever it is he talked with them about, I don't know if he was talking about eliminate it, do you think this would be grounds for recusal?
I do think it would be grounds for recusal. There's nothing that prohibits a private citizen from interacting with the president's lawyers on any matter. It's an entirely different thing when that private citizen who's providing the advice then gets nominated for the attorney general slot, because now he's got a preconceived idea of what he thinks should happen. And at the very least, that should be fully vetted by Congress as he is being going through the nominations process. I also think that depending on what his views are, he might have to step back and recuse himself. Like, he can have a very different opinion than the special counsel, and as long as he's not implicated as Jeff Sessions was, which is why Jeff Sessions recused himself, I don't know that he needs to. But I think it would be wise in terms of keeping those powers separate for him to step back and let that process move forward.
And then the question is how much he will allow to be made public.
That's right. And I think he's also, if he's in cahoots with the Trump administration about the attorney general process and about the special counsel process, that makes the whole process come together. It is like a sort of like a collusion type scheme. And that's really problematic. You just don't want the attorney general to be the person that's gaming the entire system, both from the administration side and from the prosecutorial side, if that's what happens.
So let's talk about his record, because it's not only about where he stands on the Mueller probe. I mean, he has a long record around, for example, as you said, mass incarceration. He was involved in the pardon of six Reagan officials for the Iran-Contra scandal. The significance of this, especially in light of the investigations that are going on around Trump and who's being offered pardons, who's going to jail.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, at some level, his involvement in the pardons, although problematic politically at the time, we're in a situation where President Trump will pardon almost anybody for anything. It's almost like these random pardons that he's giving out, like party favors. So at some level, I don't expect that Barr will have a huge influence on that, because the president is moving it forward. What's more concerning to me, I think, is the question of asylum and immigration. And back in the 1990s, 1991, there was a coup in Haiti that deposed President Aristide. And that Barr was one of the key figures that created the idea of creating detention camps at Guantanamo for HIV Haitians. And you have to remember that tens of thousands of Haitians were fleeing Haiti at the time, as you know, as you've reported on and if you've been there, coming to Florida seeking asylum. Rather than giving them asylum, they essentially created a two-tier—first of all, they tried to detain them on boats and interdict them, but they also created basically an HIV camp, because a number of people that were coming through were HIV positive. And he was the chief architect behind that particular program.
This was the first U.S. prison at Guantanamo.
The first U.S. prison at Guantanamo. And that prison was closed down by Michael Ratner and the Center for Constitutional Rights through litigation, what we call the first Guantanamo litigation. And we're trying to close the second prison down as well. But the important piece there is that as an asylum question, William Barr saw people coming from Haiti not as asylees, but largely as people that were threats to both the democratic system and threats to the economy. He's quoted as saying that why would we let all of these Haitians come into the United States, into Florida, so close to the election, indicating that this, there's a political view of this, that these folks that are coming in are largely going to create political havoc for the Republicans in Florida, which was a key state and remains one. So the idea now, what we're looking at with President Trump's view of asylum, which is wrong and illegal and seriously problematic, having someone like William Barr, who is an old hand at not only denying people asylum unconstitutionally, but creating illegal structures to detain folks, is going to be really, really problematic. Who knows where that's going to go?
Immigration, Vox reports that in 1992, quote, Barr rolled out a multi-million dollar plan to beef up security in the San Diego-Tijuana area, where crossings were then concentrated. One component of that plan, building a steel fence with the assistance of the Department of Defense, the San Diego-Tijuana area started a border-wide trend of building physical barriers to prevent crossings in populated areas, funneling immigrants toward the Arizona desert, and more recently, gang-controlled crossings in the Rio Grande Valley. Again, that from Vox.
Yeah.
Vince.
That's, you know, we're looking at someone who's essentially the legal architect of some of the problems that we have right now. You know, the idea we're having the whole government is partially shut down because of a border wall question. And William Barr was able to move forward and to create a wall, a deterrent wall in the San Diego area almost 20 years ago. I expect that if he were named
barring people from
crossing over into the United States, as it were. And I suspect that if he is appointed as Attorney General in this context, we're going to see much more aggressive moves around questions of walls, much more problematic rhetoric about how people come in and who doesn't come in a confusion between people that are coming in for immigration purposes, people that are coming in for asylum purposes, and people that are fleeing persecution.
The ACLU has called Barr the godfather of the NSA's bulk data collection program. Again, known for helping to develop the secret program, which became a blueprint for the NSA's mass phone surveillance effort. After leaving government, he becomes general counsel of Verizon at a time when the telecom giant was secretly working with the NSA warrantless surveillance program.
Yeah. You know, for all of the talk about transparency that he's going to do today, we have to remember that he was in with his corporate hat on, ushering in an era in which corporations and the government colluded to spy on tens of thousands, if not millions, of people through corporate networks. He's someone that I think views mass surveillance, mass incarceration, mass denials of asylum as an operative law enforcement tool. I don't think that he's found a sweeping program that he hasn't liked. And he seems very not concerned at all with the effect on innocent people, with the idea of our civil liberties to be free from that type of secret surveillance, to be free from being able to be thrown into camps, to be free from being pushed back to our former countries, seeking asylum. He doesn't really care about any of that stuff. All he really cares about is the massive power of the government to be able to sweep people into huge boxes and sort of weed out the bad folks later.
Meanwhile, the Supreme Court refused to hear a challenge to the legality of Trump's decision to name Matthew Whitaker acting attorney general. And the Democrats are dealing with this as well. As long as someone isn't put in permanently, Whitaker is there.
Yeah, and the controversy there is that it was essentially a back pocket appointment that didn't go through constitutional muster, that there are no provisions to allow that to happen. And I think, you know, Whitaker's, now with Barr in play, that issue might become moot relatively quickly. But I think it goes to the idea that, number one, this administration has no idea what it's doing legally. Number two, that they will move forward with friends and family to put them into these types of positions almost by any means necessary. And number three, the big challenge with filing these lawsuits, as we all do, is that they sometimes take more time than the way that this administration is moving.
Well, I want to thank you, Vince Warren. Of course, we're going to cover this tomorrow because the hearing is today for Matthew Barr to become Attorney General of the United States under President Trump. Vince Warren, Executive Director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. When we come back, we go to the border to talk with people involved with the case of giving water and food to those who could potentially die in the harsh Sonoran desert. Why are they on trial? Stay with us. Song for Latin America by Minutemen. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As the longest government shutdown in U.S. history is 25 days old now, President Trump continues his immigration crackdown. We end today's show looking at how the Trump administration's criminalizing humanitarian aid at the border. In Tucson, Arizona, activists with the humanitarian group No More Deaths go on trial today, facing charges for a slew of federal crimes, all because of their efforts to leave water and food in the harsh Sonoran Desert to help refugees survive the deadly journey across the U.S. border. The charges were filed last year, January 2018, just a week after No More Deaths published a report accusing U.S. Border Patrol agents of routinely vandalizing or confiscating food, water, and other humanitarian aid, condemning refugees to die of exposure or dehydration. Just hours after the report was released, No More Deaths volunteer Scott Daniel Warren was arrested and charged with felony counts of harboring and conspiracy after he was observed providing migrants with food, water, and shelter over the course of 3 days. Warren faces 2 decades, 20 years in prison if convicted. No More Deaths found between 2012 and 2016, Border Patrol agents emptied nearly 4,000 gallons of water left for migrants in the desert, also confiscating food, emergency medical blankets, and other aid. For more, we're going to Tucson, where we're joined by two guests. Paige Courage-Klein is a humanitarian aid worker, volunteer with No More Deaths, and Ryan Devereaux, staff reporter at The Intercept, where he covers immigration enforcement, the drug war, and national security. His latest piece, Arizona judge in No More Deaths case, had secret talks with federal prosecutors. Let's begin there. Ryan, what did you uncover?
Yeah, thank you, Amy. So last month, motions were filed. And in a series of motions, we discovered that the judge in Scott Warren's case, who you described in the run-up to this segment, had conversations with prosecutors in his case in which the prosecutors were attempting to narrow the scope of materials that they were required to disclose in Warren's case, namely communications sent to the Border Patrol agents involved in Warren's arrest. These conversations occurred without any consultation from Warren's defense team, and Warren's defense team has since argued that they were wholly improper and called for the removal of the judge in the case and the removal of the prosecutors in the case. There was a hearing yesterday on these matters. And going forward, the judge in Warren's case is now going to be Judge Rainer Collins, who has presided over No More Deaths cases in the past. And Warren's attorneys are arguing that things be taken a step further and that the prosecutors actually be removed, the indictment be dropped against Warren, and at the very least, if failing that, that this case be taken out of the hands of the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Arizona.
Paige Korch-Klein, can you, you've been volunteering for No More Deaths for, what, 5 years. Explain exactly what volunteers do and what the 9 people who are on trial today did.
So our volunteers do a number of things. We leave humanitarian aid supplies in areas where there have been known migrant deaths. So we track where the Pima County Medical Examiner reports migrant deaths and where people are found. And then we go and try to prevent future deaths by leaving food, water, blankets in the winter, clean socks and things of that nature. And so we expanded to the Ajo Corridor in 2014. We were founded in 2004 and mostly worked around Aravaca. And what we found when we started entering into the Cabeza Prieta wilderness was absolutely devastating. We started finding human remains pretty consistently, finding the bodies of people who had died. And so we really started working out there more and having a stronger presence and putting out water. And our response from the land managers was a direct change in their permitting language to ban humanitarian aid supplies. So they added a clause in their permit application saying that volunteers specifically could not leave food, water, water containers, food containers, blankets, medical supplies, really just listing out exactly the types of aid work and aid supplies that we wanted to be leaving. So we, you know, we've been trying to be in dialogue with them, but we also have kind of moved into this time where we're having a pretty adversarial interaction and relationship with the land management out there.
Why did you get involved with this, Paige? And talk about what happened last year, almost exactly a year ago, after No More Deaths came out with a report and the first arrests were made. Well, actually, it's not the first arrests of No More Death Volunteers by any means.
Mm-hmm. So I got involved just after being in college and coming out to the border and seeing what was happening here. And it's a really devastating, compelling issue, and I think the work that No More Deaths does is really effective in intervening in it when it's able to exist. About a year ago, we published a report, part of our Disappeared series, called Interference in Humanitarian Aid, and we published documentation of Border Patrol consistently destroying our humanitarian aid supplies, as well as some video of them actually doing it. We put out trail cameras on different areas where we'd seen our water drops be destroyed, and we actually caught Border Patrol on camera destroying our aid supplies. And so we went public with that, and the video that we released went viral and was seen all around the world by millions of people. And then hours later, Scott Warren was arrested at the barn. So we see this as retaliation. It was very directly linked to the work that we were doing in uncovering Border Patrol misconduct and violence. And we're now being targeted for it.
Mm. How many people die in the desert, Paige?
That's a really hard question. We know that every year hundreds of people's bodies are found, but we know also just the nature of the southern Arizona desert and the terrain and how remote some of these areas are, how far they are. A lot of people who die in the desert are never found. So in 2017, when we really started doing more work on Cabeza Prieta, there were 32 bodies found, many of those by our volunteers and other humanitarian aid organizations. But we also know of many other cases that are unresolved, where we know somebody was in the area of Cabeza Prieta and was never seen again. What's notable as well is that Cabeza Prieta has really, really limited access. So some of the times that we've been able to really get out into the wilderness and deep in there, we've had to actually do overnight hikes. And on some of those hikes, we've found up to 3 sets of remains in a single day. Cabeza has really limited access. We can barely get out there, but there's an area just north of there that is an active bombing range that people are also being funneled to cross through. And that area has 0 public access. So you look on the maps of known migrant deaths, and there's a lot of blank spots on the bombing range, and that we absolutely know that that is not because nobody is dying there. It's because nobody is being found there. So the numbers that we have are not really reflective of what's truly happening.
Ryan Devereaux, you wrote a piece for The Intercept in October, new documents bolster case that Border Patrol retaliated against humanitarian group. Tell us what you found, and then talk about all the cases today. It's not all 9 people who are going on trial today. 4 people are, and what each of their cases involved and what they face.
Right. It's complicated. As you mentioned, there's four people going on trial today, and those are four defendants in the Cabeza cases. So those defendants are basically being charged with violating rules on the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Refuge, namely trespassing onto designated wilderness and littering for leaving behind humanitarian aid supplies, food, water, etc. Four other Cabeza defendants will be heading to trial later with similar charges. Those individuals were involved in a rescue and recovery operation when they were cited for heading onto the refuge. And then finally, there's Scott Warren's case, the felony case that you mentioned in the run-up, in which he's charged with harboring and conspiracy. These charges together sort of indicate and a crackdown on No More Deaths and a crackdown on humanitarian aid work in the Arizona desert here that began really as Trump was coming into office in April 2017. Former Attorney General Jeff Sessions came down here to Arizona and basically told his prosecutors that he wanted to ramp up certain sets of charges, border-related charges, among them harboring charges. Anybody with a nexus to moving people further into the United States was not only fair game, he wanted to see those kinds of cases brought. And in filings that we've seen in the No More Deaths cases since then, we know that the Border Patrol started taking a hard look at No More Deaths around April, around the time of Sessions' visit. The agency raided a camp that No More Deaths has used for, you know, more than a decade. It was a provocative action. And then there was this back and forth in the Ajo corridor in Cabeza Prieta over regulations and access to the refuge where No More Deaths was expanding its work, finding more and more human remains. By the end of 2017, these charges started to come in against volunteers for working on the refuge. And then in January of last year, a year ago to this week, Warren was arrested on the day that this report came out. Since that time, in the year that's followed, we've seen a lot of activity in these cases in pretrial motions. Attorneys for No More Deaths have been arguing that these arrests, these prosecutions, violated the religious freedom of the defendants. They've pushed the government to release documents related to Warren's arrest, as I mentioned earlier. And what we're going to be seeing in the weeks ahead is a real sort of interrogation of what exactly has been going on in the border. It's important to keep in mind here that the sort of targeting of humanitarian aid on the border is part of a larger crackdown that the Trump administration has been orchestrating on the border that extends to family separation. It extends to the sort of clogging of ports of entry for asylum seekers. So, you know, in these trials, there's a ton at stake, and it all starts today.
And Ryan, the history of No More Deaths is an extension of the sanctuary movement of the 80s, which actually continues today.
That's correct, Amy. In the 1980s here in southern Arizona, a collection of religious leaders, priests, nuns, etc., basically came together using the Underground Railroad as a blueprint to move asylum seekers from Central America who were fleeing U.S.-backed dirty wars there into the United States when they sort of discovered that the Reagan administration was illegally blocking access to asylum for those folks. And the sort of reverberations of that can be felt today. A massive government investigation, undercover investigation, was launched into the movement. The churches were infiltrated. Secret recordings were made of sermons. Religious leaders were indicted, charged, prosecuted with some of the same charges that Scott Warren faces today, harboring, smuggling types of charges. It was a huge sort of galvanizing moment that sort of gave birth to the humanitarian aid community that exists in southern Arizona today. So we're seeing history repeat itself in many ways here in Tucson.
Well, Ryan Devereaux, I want to thank you for being with us, and we'll link to your pieces at The Intercept at democracynow.org. And Paige Korich-Klein, thanks so much for joining us, humanitarian aid worker volunteer with No More Deaths. Again today, four No More Deaths volunteers are going on trial in Tucson, Arizona, and we'll follow that trial. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Massoud, Trina Nadura, Tamer Maria Studio, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFlippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Graham, David Prude. If you want to sign up for our Daily Digest, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.